You're listening to Girovagando, the cycling podcast at the 2021 Giro d'Italia, powered by Super Sapiens, energy management for committed athletes and coaches. Today, we are in Sega di Ala.
Well, Daniel, we can finally unveil
Our mystery signing. And it's, unfortunately, it's not Patrick Lefebvre. It's someone who has various things in common with Patrick Lefebvre, actually. Former team manager, former major team manager. Bit of a bon vivant. More than a bit of a bon vivant.
He's younger than Patrick Lefebvre. Got a few more years in him yet. Brian Nygaard. We've completed the circle because you joined us on our first Girovagando podcast in Milan.
He's back. Watch out, Turin. Wine budget.
In Turin. Well, Brian, it's great to have you back because we will let you speak in a moment as well. But Daniel leaves on Friday for the Dauphiné, so you'll be
you'll be
carrying us through to Milan.
I actually didn't know that when I signed up for this, Richard. I'm sorry.
Well, I'm sorry. You know now.
It's a further incentive.
It's going to be a lot of fun. We're going to take the podcast to a new level, Brian, you and me, once Daniel's left. So he's been holding us back. He's like a handbrake on the podcast.
Does Brian get to do the, well, where are we, Brian?
Where are we, Brian? Become?
Well, Richard, we're in Sega di Ala. Today, I actually think, was a wine stage, at least looking at the scenery and everything. But for once, the bike racing actually was way more relevant than the vineyards.
Nonetheless, we do have to say as a point of order what we're drinking, Brian.
Yeah, I was actually trying to do a blind tasting with you just before and you failed miserably. But we're drinking a Traminer, a local Traminer from Hofstetter. So we are sort of in the outskirts of the Trentino area. I guess we have the Lago Ligada just on the other side. But we are in a very, very nice wine area for a lot of different varietals, mainly whites. And that's what we're having now.
Well, you know, we're driving through all these beautiful vineyards and you were telling us all about irrigation and things while Bernal's struggling to hold the wheel in front. No, our eyes have been...
lecturing me about the oak using Argyle Brunello the other day when Remco Evenepoel was losing the Giro d'Italia.
Our eyes have been very much on the race because, well, we've got a race on our hands, haven't we?
Finally, we had a proper Giro d'Italia
even Daniel's
stage today.
Excited.
What do you mean...
Well, you hadn't been finding the racing all that captivating, had you?
No, and for exactly the reasons, well, it was demonstrated today what a Giro stage in Myers should be like and, you know, what it is like when there's a race behind and at the front. And that's what we saw today. And it was a fantastic sort of, well, tug of war between the breakaway and the general classification guys behind it. And actually, the breakaway still won out, but it didn't feel anything like it has done over the last few days when the breakers won.
I suspect very few riders could have survived the onslaught from behind in the way that Dan Martin did. He won the stage, but that's a spoiler alert because the stage 17 from Canazzei to Sega di Ala with a really tough climb at the end. And The nature of that climb was to prove pretty significant. Some riders had wrecked it, some had not. And that maybe had an impact today. But it took a while for the break to go clear. Several riders had a go, including lucky Larry Warbass. He had a good go, but...
Not to be confused with lucky...
Lorenzo,
more of him later.
I think he did make it into a move at one point, didn't he? But a big breakaway form, some really good riders in it. King of the Mountains, Geoffrey Bouchard, Jenny Moscon from Ineos. Dries de Bont was there. He's in every breakaway. Luis Leon Sanchez, Felix Groschartner. I'm just reeling off a few of the hitters who were there. James Knox of the Cycling Podcast. He was there. Peter Seri, his De Koenig Quickstep teammate. Dan Martin was there. Young Matteo Jorgensen was there. Anyone else? Antonio Pedrero was there. There were a few others as well. It was a strong group. They got a decent advantage, but behind Bike Exchange were doing an awful lot. Your former team, one of your former teams, Brian, they were doing an awful lot of work on the front, and I think there was a bit of confusion about that or people wondering why, because Simon Yates has been very erratic at this Giro. you know, great one day, not so great the next day. But obviously had a lot of confidence in him today, put a lot of work into today, and you could argue that it maybe paid off in the end. There was a bad crash in the stage that also disrupted things. Remco Evenepoel, more bad luck for him. He finished the stage with a very swollen elbow, so who knows whether he will continue. A couple of bike exchange riders came off there. Nick Schultz, who's been riding extremely well. Mikael Nieve came down too. And Giulio Ciccone of Trek Segafredo, and he paid for that later on. When they reached the climb up to the finish, that front group had been reduced to just four strong riders. Dan Martin, Bouchard, King of the Mountains, Pedrero and Moscon. But Martin did not hang about. He really turned the screw early on in the climb, took off on his own. The gap now was down to sort of 2 minutes, and it looked like if we had a proper GC battle behind, Martin would not hold on. But hold on, he did, and he won the stage. But behind, there was a lot of excitement into the final 4 kilometres, and with Jonathan Castrovieco doing a lot of work, but not really riding too hard. He was just keeping Dan Martin at about a minute and a half. It was 4K to go. Joao Almeida put in attack. He was the first of the GC riders to really have a go. Simon Yates countered. Bernal was straight onto him. So was Dani Martinez. Damiano Caruso, who started the day second, rode at his own pace. And that was to prove a sensible strategy, because Bernal paid for the effort of following Yates, who bridged up very quickly to Almeida. And, we saw the first signs of weakness from Bernal. He cracked a little bit. It wasn't clear whether he'd just gone too deep following Yates or he'd had some kind of hunger flat. He said after the stage that it wasn't that it was he'd gone too deep. He didn't know the climb. He had not wrecked the climb. Yates and Dan Martin had both wrecked the climb, and Dan Martin in particular said how valuable that had been.
Interestingly, a few days ago when Bernal was asked about, I think it was the Zoncolan, he almost suggested that he's ideologically opposed to reconning climbs in this similar way.
Reconning?
Right, I always struggle with that word. Reckoning, reconnoitering. In a similar way to Pantani. Pantani was always dead against, I mean, back then in the 90s, it was less in vogue anyway. Fewer riders used to do it. I think Pantani reconned two
MotoGP
climbs.
MotoGP going on here. Is this Carl Crutchlow on his way to see Remco Evenepoel?
I think
today might not be the right day to talk about this story.
No. I think Pantani, back in his day, he reckoned two climbs of Piane Monte Campione, where he famously overcame Pavel Tonkov, and maybe the other one, the Mortirolo, but there were only two, and he didn't believe in it either.
Believe in it. Well, we saw a cracking GC race. Bernal was dropped, and for a moment it looked like he really had cracked completely. Dani Martinez dropped back and was cajoling him on, shouting at him, urging him on. There were some great pictures of that. Meanwhile, Almeida and Yates carried on riding hard. Almeida actually dropped Yates towards the line, and he finished second on the stage to Dan Martin. He was closing pretty fast. So on the stage it was Dan Martin, Joao Almeida, Simon Yates, Diego Ulisi, and then Caruso, who gained 3 seconds on Bernal, just 3 seconds. And on GC now, Bernal, Caruso, Yates, Vlasov, Carthy, Bardet. I mean, he's not in that much of a worse situation tonight, but Yates was obviously the big winner today.
Yeah, I think I would like to qualify a little bit the reconnaissance or the absence of it in Bernal's case, that I don't really think that would change the type of legs you have. They have access to so much information, and they know exactly the steepness of the climb and the length of the climb, and they obviously also know themselves. So I think Bernal cracked today not because of the lack of recon, because he was in real trouble. And the interesting element today was that at some point, I think Almeida went just for the heck of it, but I think Simon Yates saw something. He saw a sink in the armor. He saw some weakness in Bernal, and that's why he went. So strategically, it was the right moment for them to put pressure on Bernal, and they saw something that I don't think anyone else saw, at least not as a spectator, that he was definitely in real trouble today.
The gaps are still, you know, still 2:21 to Caruso, 3:23 to Yates. Vlasov lost some time but held on to fourth overall today. Carthy was a bit of a loser today, dropped to fifth.
From the point of view of the GC, it was kind of the wrong guy to be attacking Bernal. If you were a neutral and you wanted to see the race as open as possible until the end, it needed to be Caruso, didn't it? And Caruso, I don't think he was on a particularly great day, and he wasn't able to capitalize.
I think we got confirmation today that Caruso would like to finish on the podium. I mean, that okay, he was riding in a very sensible, pragmatic way too, and maybe in the only way he could ride, but the podium is definitely something he's aiming for here.
And rightfully so. He came into this, I think, to play the second fiddle for Landa. So this is a phenomenal result for him if he should end on the podium, and I think his team would be happy with it.
Pope Landa. Pope Caruso?
Still guessing on fueling? Not sure what or when to eat and drink on rides that matter? Never again. Optimize your fueling strategy with real-time glucose data, actionable insights, and personalized analytics. We're here to help you achieve your performance goals. Go to supersapiens.com for more on how to track your energy levels and fuel for success. The Cycling Podcast, powered by Super Sapiens.
Thanks very much indeed to our title sponsor, Super Sapiens. Very grateful to them for their support. They are all about energy management for committed athletes. And we're all athletes, and we can all use Super Sapiens. And we've
really?
Been running... Yes, Daniel. Yes, we could all benefit from monitoring our blood glucose levels. And we've been running a competition in conjunction with Super Sapiens to offer 3 months of Super Sapiens to anybody who has got a cycling goal, an ambition they want to achieve, and they think Super Sapiens might be able to help them achieve it. Let's hear our latest entrants tonight. We've got two tonight. Let's hear their pitch to win Super Sapiens.
Hi, my name is Kai.
And my name is Alfie.
And we go to Auckland's College,
where we train every day of the week between 2 to 4 hours.
My goal for this year is to get onto the Team Novo Nordisk development team and progress onto the under 23 scene.
And my goal for this year is to get top 10 in one of the national series races.
The reason why we should get picked is because I myself use something like the Super Sapiens. Because I'm a type 1 diabetic, I use a Dexcom G6 to regularly monitor my blood glucose levels while out on the road. So, if we do win this, Alfie can wear the Super Sapien and we can compare on how exercise affects a non-diabetic and a diabetic while out riding.
Also, I can use this to analyse my blood sugar levels and what affects it when I'm out training to stop bonking in the future.
I hope you enjoyed, and I'll see you later. Bye.
Thanks very much for that. And if you would like to enter competition, there's still time. Go to thecyclingpodcast.com to find out how to enter. Just send your audio clip through thecyclingpodcast.com. Daniel,
yes,
Bernal, the big story today.
Well, certainly, and I suppose over the last few days, we'd kind of re-elevated him to the sort of realm, the dimension of the Pogacars and the Rogliches. We'd sort of perhaps, re-evaluated what we'd been saying about him over the last, year or so. We'd seen him as vulnerable. We'd seen him as not really belonging in that sort of super all category. In the same way that those guys are certainly in it. But then he looked invulnerable, and we didn't envisage seeing any vulnerabilities between now and Milan. And we kind of always fall into this trap in Grand Tours.
You certainly do.
Well, no, we
Brian
we do.
Nodding, I mean, enthusiastically.
We become very sort of complacent and blasé about the guy who's in the jersey.
It's a glass half full kind
but
of...
But is that not a legacy of, these dynasties that you talk about, Daniel, when we go through periods where a rider like Chris Froome goes several years without ever looking that vulnerable, but we are in a period now where there isn't a dynasty. We're not in the middle of a dynasty. We're in quite an exciting period where there are riders out there who could begin to form a dynasty.
I think another thing we overlook is how much now Grand Tours and Grand Tour directors, route designers, stack all the drama towards the back end, and the teams are very, very aware of that now, and the riders are very, very aware of that now, and they calibrate their energy expenditure on the basis of that.
Yeah, and I think also when they do their course management, they intelligently try to figure out the specific stages where they can gain time. And you could even say, he's cushioned himself rather well, but now, in the first part of this Giro, And the reason why he would do that is not, I think, just because of the potential of losing this, some ground on the time trial. It's actually to make sure that should he have a bad day or consecutive bad days, he still has a reasonable margin. So I don't think it's not an ego thing when he goes out to gain time in the initial part of the Giro. It's to cushion himself for situations like today. I think the bigger question is now, is was today a symptomatic reveal of his current state? You know, are there more options for the other guys to really take another go another round with him and put him into trouble?
There's blood in the water tonight.
There's blood in the water, but what's fascinating is to see Simon Yates resurgent, because of course this is exactly what happened to him in 2018.
Yeah, it is. Although I'm very conscious, you made a good point the other day, Rich, about
what?
As always. Well, yeah, you did. About as always, you know, we always focus on the pink jersey, the leader of the general classification, and we forget these sort of fringe marginal battles for the minor placings, essentially. And, you know, we talked the other day about how EF Education, first their big move, their big statement. Charlie Wargelius didn't like us calling it a statement, or didn't like you calling it a statement, but it was a very successful move in that it put Yates out the back and they gained a couple of minutes. Today the tables will turn. You know, forget about what Bernal did. Yates put, you know, how much did he put between himself and Carthy? And he certainly...
He turned the table.
Yeah, he did. I mean, they landed a major blow on that front.
I mean, Yates has got almost 3 minutes now on Carthy.
Yeah, so that was a hugely successful move brought about by, well, the team chasing, putting... Okay, you could look at it and say, well, they wanted the stage win and they almost reeled the break back. But more importantly, they put Carthy on the ropes.
And Caruso is still there, isn't he? I mean, when he caroused up to Bernal, having initially been dropped, I thought there's a chance here for Caruso to go past him. But he didn't, you know, he was very much, he's riding that climb in a very sensible way. But I will ask you a question. Who finished fourth in the final time trial of the Giro 2 years ago?
Damiano Caruso.
Well done, Daniel. Fantastic. You win a prize.
Damiano Caruso, who's won one professional race in his entire career.
I think also the way he interprets what is now his GC ambition is to make as few mistakes as possible. I think that's how he goes about trying to finalize that last, you know, attempt to be on the podium.
He's got a great chance of being on the podium now, hasn't he?
Yes, he has. I spoke to the team Bahrain Victorious's technical director, Vladimir Mihailovic, after the finish. He was down at the bus compound. Just about, well, what he made of Caruso's performance today and where they go from here. What was Damiano telling you today about how he was feeling and what messages were they getting in the car?
You know, it's I am not sport director. I am here in different role, no? But with Damiano is always positive. No, always positive, very nice guy. And his influence in the team is very... very good and nice, and somebody who drives team forward with mood also. And in situation like this, you're also afraid a bit to ask, how do you feel, what do you think, no? So we are observing rider, his body language, his way of behavior. And when you see that somebody put the music and on the speaker in the bus, full gas on, say, okay, everything is in place, let's go outside. We did our job. They know how is stage, we know how stage is in front of us, and let's stick to the plan and hope to the best.
What was the music, can you remember?
Today was some dance house. What is, yeah, a bit out of my range. So it is not rock, it is not something what I get emotion. But I'm very happy because it's positive for the guys.
And when Bernal started to drop back, it looked as though for a second as though he might collapse completely, as we saw years ago with, I don't know, Cadel Evans in 2002. Were you thinking that as well?
Yeah, look, fortune of Bernal is that he had Dani Martinez. No, we had Pello Bilbao. So this is all the great teammates that can... They could be the leaders also, but when you have helpers like this, they save the team. But for sure, you know, at the end, this climb, hard as it is, it's a lot in mental game, no? So for sure, when Damiano saw the Bernal dropping, he gained 3-4 watts because he was dropped before the Bernal, no? So that hard climbs was a bit hard part of the climb was a bit more longer. I think that Damiano today was able to drop Egan, but let's hope that he will be able to do that in the next stages.
And just finally, am I right in thinking you're pretty confident that Damiano is someone who usually doesn't get better, but doesn't get a lot worse in the third week?
Yeah, this is the rule. But this historically watching, yes, it's correct. No, but you know, you're always a bit cautious. As a team, we are doing everything to save the rider from any problems, health problems, extra stress, save his body and his mind with special attention. What we are giving all the team, because at the end we stayed with only five riders, and Rafa Vals had a hard crash today in the descent, so we need to see. And he's riding
already with broken ribs.
So we need to see how he will be able to continue. But yes, regularity is characteristic of Damiano, no? Until now, and let's hope that it will be also now.
Chaps, I found out something very interesting about Caruso today, or I had my memory jogged. Maybe I knew this already. His father was a policeman, but he was deployed in the early 90s or late 80s as a bodyguard, or as part of the sort of the group of bodyguards, or what do you call it? When there's a division of
special
the
guards,
special
or, I don't know.
Some kind of special division to look after the very famous Italian judge Giovanni Falcone, the anti-mafia prosecutor who was killed in a bombing on the motorway between the Palermo airport and Palermo in 1992. Well, it was the anniversary on Sunday, and you know, it's an occasion that's honoured every year in Italy. The President Mattarella gave a speech the other day, and one of the great heroes in Italian modern history, he was killed in this bombing. His sort of partner in fighting crime, Paolo Borsellino, was killed a few weeks later. But yeah, Caruso's father was one of, I don't know whether at the actual time of Falcone's death he was fulfilling that role, but certainly over the course of his career, that was one of the roles that he fulfilled.
A real hero.
Yeah.
I'm searching for some kind of parallel, but it's not coming to me immediately. Maybe it will later on.
Caruso, of course, he's very proud of his Sicilian roots. I mean, he's talked about this at length. People ask him why he doesn't go and live in Lugano or Monte Carlo. And, you know, we've talked at great length in the podcast over the years about Sicily and its problems. And he's very conscious of that, Caruso as well. And he says that leaving to go and pay less tax in Switzerland or in Monte Carlo would be like turning his back on Sicily, and that would sort of encapsulate and demonstrate why Sicily has the problems it does, because, you know, people turn their back on it, and the Italian government has turned its back on Sicily.
Well, another interview I did at the buses was Rod Ellingworth. He's returned to Team Ineos from Bahrain, of course. He was running the Bahrain team last year, but he's gone back to Team Ineos, not quite to his old job, something a little bit different, although the job title's changed there a lot, so I'm not quite sure what his current job title is. But I was very keen to speak to him about Bernal, how he's found him, because of course he worked with him a couple of years ago, the year that he won the Tour de France. You know, we were speaking before Bernal's difficulties on the climb, and it was quite interesting what Rod said about every day at the Giro in particular being so important.
You were at the team in 2019. How does the Bernal that we're seeing here at the Giro compared to the Bernal in the 2019 Tour?
Well, I wasn't working at the Tour then. I'd actually left just before. But, you know, I'd known Egan when he first joined the team. And I think he certainly moved on himself. You know, his own personality has moved on. He's got a lot sort of more confident in himself, you know. I mean, he certainly started at the beginning of this year and he was, you know, he had a tough year last year, so he certainly, you know, he wasn't so confident at the beginning of the year, which I think is natural, really. But just here, I've been so impressed with, you know, he's got that physical element, but just how he is mentally is just superb, you know, and the way he treats everybody, riders, staff, But you know, in the rider meetings, he's absolutely bang on the money. He really understands it all. He's very good tactically, and he just knows how to get the best out of his team. So, fair play to him. Yeah.
It seems like you're not. He's not taking anything for granted here. You know, there's still the time trial. He's clearly the best rider in the race, but it looks like he's keen to not take any chances at all before that time trial on Sunday.
Well, I think it's just the nature of the Giro, isn't it? You know, you just never know what's around the corner, really. And all these descents are always a bit dangerous. And just the nature of the Giro in general, you know, you get big groups always go away, which you don't seem to get in the other Grand Tours. So, you know, I think we're just taking it day by day, you know. And then this is the dangerous moment for us, really. You're only a few days away from the final, and I think if you take the eye off the ball, you get into trouble, you know. So, I think everybody, staff and riders, we're all staying on it 100%.
How, it's an unanswerable question in a way, but how would he match up in this form to Pogacar and Roglic?
Who knows? You know, it's one of them, isn't it? I think everybody would look forward to the moment when they all sort of race together. So I think Egan's again one of the greats. I think, you know, he's already proved that, and I think you can see that day in the rain the other day again. You know, he was really on top of things. The cold didn't affect him. I think the best ones are brilliant at that sort of stuff, aren't they? So I think he's right on the money.
Do you think he'll ride the Tour next year?
Who knows? We haven't talked that far. You know, at the end of the day, he's in the Giro. That was his target this year. So that's as far as we get, really. Yeah.
The Cycling Podcast at the 2021 Giro d'Italia is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thanks very much indeed to Science in Sport, our sponsor. I bet Brian knows the Science in Sport code.
CP25?
SISCP25, better than Daniel.
Close enough.
SISCP25 at scienceandsport.com if you'd like 25% off all your Science in Sport goodies, is that the right term? Sports nutrition products, sciencesport.com, SISCP25. And we're running a competition with Science and Sport to win an £80 bundle of Science and Sport products every Sunday. If you can go to thecyclingpodcast.com and predict the winner of Sunday's stage, you will be in with a chance. If you successfully predict the winner of the stage, you'll be in with a chance of winning an £80 bundle of Science and Sport goodies. I should mention before we go on, the second batch of Stacey Snyder's mugs, cappuccino sets and gelato bowls went on sale today, and they sold out as they always do. So lots of money raised for the Marina Romoli Onlus, the Marina Romoli Foundation, and the Masaka Cycling Club in southern Uganda. So those two great causes will benefit thanks to your generosity. And to all those who got bowls, mugs and cappuccino sets, congratulations. And we hope you enjoy them. To those who missed out, we're very sorry, but we'll be doing more at the Tour de France, of course. We should mention the wine as well. I mean, you mentioned the wine stage today. It should have been the wine stage. Daniel, we combined with Divine Cellars in London to... you curated a case of wine with Greg from Divine, a Giro case, and it's been
still available
very
and
popular.
Will be available all year. Indeed, and we'll be unveiling our Tour de France selection soon, our Vuelta selection. Details about those are on our website, aren't they, Richard?
Thecyclingpodcast.com, that's right, yes. So Dan Martin, a great stage win for him, another breakaway survivor, but this one a little bit different, wasn't it? And he's a GC rider on his day, and the way that he went about winning that stage was impressive. As he said in the press conference, he had wrecked the climb. He knew how steep it was in parts, and he knew how to sort of judge his effort. He knew not to go too deep in that steep part, to have a bit left over the top. He reckoned he only needed 20-30 seconds with about 3Ks to go when it flattened out a bit. He judged it perfectly in the end because he was almost caught, and it was a very well taken stage win.
A surgical precision. I was noticing the way the team communicated what their ambitions were initially before the Giro. And they said they wanted to do GC with Dan Martin. And when you guys interviewed him, he was more than on the fence. I think he was more, it's a classic quote, I guess, the day-to-day approach. And it seemed like he was really gunning for the stage, and I think he managed it with real surgical precision at the end.
It was a good omen when at 7.7 kilometres from the finish, a giant panda appeared at the side of the road. Of course, the giant panda, which became synonymous with his victory at Liège-Bastogne-Liège.
Do you think it was the same one?
It could have been. It sort of chased him up that final climb to Anse that...
Not the only cycling celebrity spotted there. You saw Primoz Roglic at the buses, Daniel. Yes.
A doppelganger, yeah.
A doppelganger, a gentleman in the Slovenian champion Jumbo Visma jersey, carrying a few extra pounds, perhaps. More than Roglic. I don't want to fat shame this gentleman.
But that stage win, of course, completed Dan's set of stage wins in all three major tours. And, you know, what a career he's had. One Tour of Lombardy, one Liège-Bastogne-Liège. Maybe not someone, he's not been an era-defining rider, but he's certainly been one of the very, very best riders of the last generation. And versatile, has been successful on various different terrains, has always repaid his team's faith, you know, not necessarily in every single Grand Tour or every single Classic, but over the course of a contract of 2 years, he's always pulled out something. And in the most exalted company as well, you know, today he beat, he headed off Yates and, well, a sort of resurgent Yates.
Diamond Legs Almeida.
Yates, and that takes some doing. Only, you know, the very best at their art are able to do that, and Dan is among the best.
Final point on today then, chaps. We, as you said, blood in the water, Daniel, but is the Giro open again? I mean, the gaps are pretty significant. It would take an almighty collapse from Bernal. But is there enough there to give the likes of Simon Yates in particular some hope?
Well, there were echoes. I know Bike Exchange don't like us mentioning it, but...
Well, maybe they will now.
There were echoes, Rich. I mean... If you remember Prato Nevoso in 2018, and
it was the first sign, wasn't it?
Well, the podcast we did that night was probably quite similar. We were saying similar things then about Simon Yates that we're saying about Bernal.
And it only took you a couple of years to forget it.
Well, there were the first hints, weren't there? And we said then that momentum in Grand Tours is, you know, it's always important. It's difficult to turn that oil tanker around. Although, as a slight disclaimer to that, behind Bernal in this Giro, we've seen, you know, Carthy have a good day, then a bad day. We've seen Yates have a good day, then a bad day. And it has been that kind of race.
And Yates, even today, looked great. And Bernal talked about how savage his attacks were. But in the end, he couldn't hold on to Almeida. And had he done so, I'd feel a bit more confident about his form and his chances.
Yeah, but I think there's a general agenda here that I think we should address. Because I think that... The way it's a little bit of a Rorschach test to how you look at life, also that sometimes some journalists or people who follow the sport, they have a tendency to close the book on a bike race 5 days before it's done. And I don't, are we so easily bored? Do we lack the imagination that everything could change? Have we seen so much bike racing that we just become numb to
all of those things,
to surprises, all of the above? No, I, you know, having worked in the sport and having, I think, in a major way, refound my passion for getting excited about racing, I love that we find ourselves so wrong sometimes that we, you know, especially in the Giro and after days like today, we were at the edge of our seat and we thought, it's just going to gain a little bit more time. You had him as a favorite to win the bike race. I mean, the tables can and they might turn, and I think in cycling and in life, I think we have to be a bit more welcoming about that.
Yeah, and I think there is a definite tendency as time goes by towards hastiness and rashness in our judgments. I remember a couple of years ago with Carapaz, no one was really mentioning him after 10 days, and people were already sort of fitting Roglic for the final pink jersey in Milan, or they were... They considered it a foregone conclusion, and
The Tour as well with him last year, weren't they?
Well, yeah, the Tour de France last year was a classic example, wasn't it? But Brian, you, when we picked you up at the station in Trento today, immediately, you were sort of scowling, frowning at me, and you were ready to take exception to my pretty sort of lukewarm analysis of this Giro so far, which, you know, if you watched our video last night, I reiterated that I don't think it's been a great Giro. As I said at the start of the show today, Because we haven't had enough stages like today. We haven't had enough stages where the whole narrative of the day was knitted together and interlaced, and there were lots of different plots playing out simultaneously and not, you know, 10 kilometers apart with the break doing one thing and the GC group doing another.
Right, but with three mountain stages to go, at least when you pick me up today at the train station, the possibility was still there. And I guess it also depends a little bit what we're looking for. I know that these days end up defining the bike race because they're fantastic and everyone gets very excited about it. But I also think it depends on what you're looking for. I was the last time I was texting you about wine on the day, but when I was in Montalcino, I thought it was wonderful bike racing. And when I saw the other victories of some of the Grand Tour stage winning debutants, I think it's very touching to see that as well. I think there's so many other sub-narratives that makes for a great race. I don't have to see 5 days of GC arm wrestle to
be... Today felt like a chase. Today felt like a race.
Yeah, it was definitely a race.
And there haven't been enough days like that. It felt like it was on behind. There was an intensity to it. I mean, the weather really helped. You know, unfortunately, this race has been absolutely cursed with gloomy, dark skies, and it never really feels like a Grand Tour when you get that relentlessly day after day. Today felt like we were at the Giro d'Italia. There was colour, there was, you know, there were vineyards, there were vibrant dark greens, and you know, it was a fantastic technical show.
But you should also, you should probably hold judgment until, you know, it's usually pretty gloomy in Milano either way, but you should hold judgment until we get there. There's always the possibility, and I think it's a lesson for life, Daniel. Really, there's always a chance.
But for Daniel, the Giro finishes on Friday, so maybe that's what he was his sights were
set on. He's on his way out.
There was a nice little plug there from Brian, inadvertent, for today's Kilometer Zero, all about the stage winners, some of the surprise stage winners in this year's race, and we speak to a few of them, including Joe Dombrowski, who's been home now for the best part of 2 weeks, but we caught up with him, and that's available, Kilometer Zero, support by Super Sapiens, of course. Unfortunately, given all this enthusiasm and exuberance for the race, we have to now debunk one of the great romantic stories of this Giro. The idea that George Bennett, having ridden the Zoncolan on his way back down, then accompanied his teammate Eduardo Affini back up the mountain. There was a wonderful picture of this captured by Jared Gruber. We spoke to both Affini and Bennett this morning.
Yes, Rich. George Bennett speaking to me and our friends from Bidon this morning about not only the Affini incident on the Zoncolan, but also another famous photo. Famous, it's become famous in the last 48 hours. Him crossing the line in Cortina with a musette slung over his shoulder like a London bicycle messenger. And also talking about what a disappointment this Giro d'Italia has been for him personally.
I mean, I came here to ride the GC and I just really was exposed with a big, you know, a big weakness of mine being, you know, how cold it was, and those conditions really killed me. And I really had good legs coming in, and I really had quite good belief in myself. The team backed me, you know, it all sort of evaporated, and every mountain day has been, except for the Zoncolan, has been really cold and raining and terrible. And so yeah, I just, once I was out of the GC, you know, it took a few days to try and put that behind me and deal with the, you know, the reality of the situation that I wasn't going to be in the GC anymore. And then, you know, I'm here now, help Tobias, and also, but yeah, no, I just want to try and get a stage win and see if I can get anything out of this Giro and, you know, make the most. So.
And you were in one of the most iconic pictures of this Giro with Eduardo. Can you tell us a little bit more of that moment on Zoncolan?
I started hearing stories that people thought I rode the Zoncolan twice. I mean, mate, I hardly made it up there once. I did not ride the Zoncolan twice. But I just, when, you know, Edo did a huge job that day and I saw him coming up, I just wanted to turn around and firstly thank him for what he did, how he rode, and also just apologise for not winning the stage. I mean, I guess somehow that transcribed into me riding the Zoncolan twice.
How far did you ride with him, George?
I don't know, a couple hundred metres.
The other picture that everyone's talking about is you finishing with a musette the other day. Any story, anything to tell about that?
Oh, I got a musette with warm clothes at the top, and I looked in everything. I put the jacket, got the buff, and the rest was an undershirt, and I wasn't going to stop and strip down. I just kept it on. I was just cruising to the finish line and didn't really think much of it, but...
You know how these things go.
I'm learning.
Yeah, I'm learning how they go.
You're still enjoying it?
More than ever. I mean, despite the... despite, you know, I mean, without sounding too dramatic, I mean, this has been one of the most disappointing, you know, expectation versus reality differentials in my life. It's been extremely disappointing for how I rode. And those times are hard, of course, but in general, like, I still enjoy doing it. I'm still happy to ride my bike today. I'm still excited to be in the Giro, and you know, I'm already looking forward to my next big goals of Tokyo, looking at preparation, talking, getting things ready for this. And you just have to keep looking ahead and keep finding things that excite you. And as long as I'm still excited doing it, I like it more now that I'm a better rider than I did when I was young and I was just getting my head kicked in.
Yeah, this has been actually a big thing in the last few days. It went a little bit out of hand, and just to make it clear, I think we probably did together 50 meters or maximum 100 meters.
Don't spoil the story.
Yeah, I mean, it's nice to romanticize about cycling. I still believe that is a really nice gesture from him, and I've really said to him, thank you for what he has done. But yeah, it's also, even if you just think about it logically, it's not possible to make two times the Zoncolan. So.
Well, that was George Bennett and then Eduardo Affini. Well, Bennett said about 200 metres, Affini said about 50 metres. We'll split the difference, shall we? You also spoke to somebody else at the start this morning, Daniel.
Yes, I did, Rich. Lucky Lorenzo. Lorenzo Fortunato, the winner at Lo Zoncolan the other day. He's been a fixture in the mix zone after charming us both on Lo Zoncolan and with his press conference afterwards. Today, we were talking about his education. His degree at Bologna University, and then he shocked us, he surprised us with this.
Certo che fare la tesi sull'EPO c'è un argomento abbastanza delicato.
I did my thesis on oxygen and cycling, basically, so EPO in sport, doping and the biological passport. I got my degree in 2019 from Bologna University, degree in sports science. I mean, obviously I chose a sensitive subject, but that's why I chose it. As a cyclist and as a sports science undergraduate, it seemed like the most current, most burning question to focus on. I also had a chemistry professor who was a big cycling fan, and she had some input. So doping, the biological passport and EPO, they were the main topics. Obviously, I wasn't advocating doping, the opposite, in fact. I grew up watching cycling when doping was a huge issue, but I have to say that I haven't come into contact with it as a rider myself. Fortunately, when I turned pro, the biological passport had been in place for a while, and I've honestly never had any experience of doping. I've just studied it. I'm part of a different generation.
Io non l'ho solo studiato, ma non rientra nella mia epoca, no?
So a thesis in or on EPO and the biological passport and doping, but you know there are riders. Well, there have been riders in the past. Certainly, those who rode 10 or 15 years ago, who probably could also have. Written a pretty decent thesis on EPO.
Yes, indeed, Daniel. They could. You also spoke to another rider, not at the race anymore, sadly, Alessandro De Marchi, who spent a couple of days in the pink jersey and then suffered a terrible crash. And on crashes, by the way, just had a message from Trek Segafredo. Three of their riders went down in that crash today. Nibali went down as well, and he has had x-rays on his humerus, but he's okay. He's been in the wars a bit, hasn't he, Nibali? But
I think he fell on the same side, his right side, that he obviously had injured before the Giro and broke his wrist, didn't he, before the Giro. So it's not been easy for him. What about Remco? Any updates on him? Because, of course, he crashed as well. I mean, he crashed on the Passo San Valentino, and it's not been love at first sight for Remco as far as the Giro d'Italia has been concerned.
No, it's been a baptism of fire. I saw Patrick Lefebvre say that he thought his ego would have taken
a flicker. The Passo San Valentino, love at first sight. Not even a flicker.
Oh God, sorry.
Not even a flicker.
I'm sorry. Sorry about that. I was giving you a serious answer. Anyway, shall we hear from someone else you spoke to today?
Well, yes, one of the names, one of the figures, one of the personalities of the Giro d'Italia, certainly in its first half, the pink jersey for 2 days, Alessandro De Marchi, teammate of the stage winner, of course, Dan Martin. And I checked in with Alessandro today, partly because he was supposed to feature heavily in my Kilometre Zero on the Friuli region a couple of days ago. Alessandro hails from there. He's very proud of his Friulano roots. And I gave him a call today to see how he was getting on.
the main problem is the is around the thoracic area. So I had a big contusion on the lung, and then I broke around 6 ribs, and then also the collarbone, and this is the most painful and problematic situation. So I'm gonna need a bit of time for the ribs, and we decided to not go for the surgery for the collarbone. So it's gonna be really easy for at least for 3 weeks for the collarbone, and meanwhile I hope to be okay for the ribs. That's it.
And more important, Alessandro, to talk to me about your emotions and how they've been over the last 2 or 3 days, and particularly with the, I mean, originally I was going to speak to you about Friuli, and we were going to do a nice interview about, you know, your roots in Friuli and how strongly you feel your Friulano identity, but obviously you had a different experience at the weekend.
In the end, I completely missed this amazing three days that it could be here in Friuli, and I honestly really didn't see the stages, because I'm not ready in the mind. So so that's probably the worst thing, because I was really looking for these 3 days in Friuli, especially after the pink jersey. I would like really to be here to enjoy and to share a bit the emotion with my people, and that's it. It didn't happen. I'm back home a bit earlier than expected, and here we are.
And it was a Giro of one huge high for you, and then lows. Well, there was the low of, I suppose, of giving, well, of losing the pink jersey, but and then the injury. But you talked in the Giro d'Italia podcast about this lovely moment when you realised that you were going to lose the pink jersey on the climb. What is it, the Forca di Presta? You sort of took a couple of minutes just to contemplate and just to savour what happened at Sestola. Has there been any more of that, or in spite of the injury, a little bit more time to reflect and, you know, reflect on the good things about this Giro?
Well, yeah, in the end, this big injury, this big crash, it really forced me to be back with the mind on that days, because I really want to leave the Giro with a nice memory. So I'm gonna try to really to forget as soon as possible that the crash and the way I stopped the Giro, because I have really the need to focus on the good things, on the nice things happening in the Giro, and then the 2 days, let's say 3 days in pink have been really amazing, and from the beginning to the end I really enjoyed it, and I had the back a lot from the people, from public, and also for all the people from the big circus, no? And that is really important for a rider.
During the Giro, when you were here, you talked a bit about, you mentioned a couple of times that you're in a new house, and you were checking in at home. You're excited about how the grass was growing in your garden. How's it looking?
Yeah, now it's looking really nice. I came back yesterday, and I came back with the sun. So I'm just coming. I was coming home, and the sun was going out, and I went immediately on the terrace to see the grass, and I can say that it's going really well. It's going better than my Giro. So now I have a really green green grass behind, and I'm really at least I'm happy for them.
And last thing, Alessandro, like, you must be aware of how, well, what a sort of strong emotional reaction that your pink jersey provoked, and how you know, how much support there was for you. I mean, why do you think that is? I mean, you've done two or three interviews over the past couple of years, big interviews that I think have captured people's attention and maybe their imagination, and they've identified with you. Maybe they identify with the setbacks that you've been through in your career, also your age. You know, people like to see an older rider kind of defying the odds. But what is it, do you think, about you? You're probably the worst person to answer this question, but why do you think people identify with you so much?
That's really difficult to say, but probably there is something, there is a bit of something. Of everything, a bit of everything that you said to explain this big reaction. Probably, I mean, the way I did, I really interpreted the cycling these years. Maybe also the fact that I'm 35 years old, so I cannot say that I'm a young. In cycling, so that is also another thing, and probably also the way many times I lost something. So I lost a race, I lost a big result, I lost the season for injuries, or I don't know. So probably these are the most common thing in a cyclist, and in the end, it happened to me something that is not really common. So I think it's probably like that the people like that, also to a guy like me can happen something something really big, something emotional, something like a big prize, a big surprise.
They see you as the underdog in a certain sense.
That's for sure. And I can say that I really received back more than what I did in that 3 days, because I did a nice stage on the fourth stage, and I gained this jersey fighting and everything, but in the end I really to admit that I received back more than what I did, really.
Well, that was Alessandro De Marchi, sadly missed by the race, but I guess he will have enjoyed Dan Martin's stage win. Any other business, chaps, before we sign off for the evening?
Well, we're staying in Rovereto tonight. I've been told by John Foote, our friend, the historian, professor, scholar, that the Modern Art Museum in Rovereto is not to be missed. One of the best in Europe, said John. A real sort of hipster, under the radar.
Not
cultural tip for us there.
Not to be missed, but I suspect we will.
We probably won't miss the bell in Rovereto, the famous bell which was made from the melted down guns of, I think, only the First World War, but it was built to commemorate the people who died in both the First World War and the Second World War. It's very famous. It's the most famous landmark in Rovereto, and I think the race is going to head out of Rovereto past the bell tomorrow, but we'll probably hear it.
Yeah, chaps, just breaking news. Just had a diary entry from James Knox, who was in the thick of the action today. Haven't had a chance to listen to it yet, but let's catch up with James.
From the comments I get on Twitter now, it sounds like everyone's just sick and tired of hearing me whinge and groan. So, got up the road today. I guess I'm pretty happy with myself. Wanted to be in the break. You know, was actually quite nervous before the start. Team were putting a bit of pressure on to try and do something. Yeah, try and get up the road. And, yeah, it was pretty scrappy, pretty hard. Downhill, headwind isn't really my speciality, to be honest. It was not really for me. It was a lot of trying and getting nowhere. Mikkel and Elio were around me a lot to try and make some effort for me to get in the move. And then at one point it looked like Seri was gone and maybe that was it. But there was a group sort of dangling in the middle. And then I sort of latched onto Dan Martin, who had a teammate to sort of drag him across. And then he did a bit of a kick also to get across to the very front. And yeah, after a lot of flapping around into that downhill headwind. And it was a pretty decent sized group, I think. Maybe 16, 18 guys. We managed to chop off enough that we got over that little bump, that little 3K climb, which was pretty hard. With a bit of an advantage over some guys who tried to come across. And then from there, yeah, we just... Well, yeah, it was actually a pretty... I mean, I don't know what the TV images look like, but it wasn't the most cohesive breakaway. It didn't help that, obviously, once Bike Exchange started riding behind, it takes a little bit of the sting out of the emphasis. Moscon was sat on. Mosca from Trek was sat on. I presume they were disappointed not to get any climbers in the break. And then from there, yeah, a lot of guys in the... Oh, a lot of teams, sorry, in the break had multiple riders, and they sort of committed to one. You know, like, Jorgensen pulled for Pedrero, the Wanty boys pulled for Jan Hurt. And unfortunately, there was just a lot of guys trying to just sit on the back. Me and Terry just tried to keep rolling through and not do anything silly, but yeah, it was very stop-start. Obviously, the headwind wasn't helping anyone. It was pretty... wasn't easy going. And then, yeah, then it hit the climb. Already hurting by this point, really. But dug in as much as possible. Couldn't follow the... Well, I'm pretty sure it was Dan Martin who did the acceleration. So, got to take my hat off to him today. What he did there. Jumping a lot at the start. Never skipping a turn in the break. He also changed his bike, I think. Then he made the selection on the first climb. Took a few guys. I think a couple more came back across, which I'm surprised, but because they were just that Androni lad and the Bardiani lad were only just ahead of me and Seri at the top, but must have taken big risks to get back. And then, yeah, me and Seri were sort of caught in no man land at this point. We were with Jan Hirt and Badliatti with FDJ. And, yeah, we heard that Remco had crashed and the first DS had stayed with him, and then second DS basically told us, yeah, he's going back to the group with Joao and we should just, yeah, wait and, yeah, help Joao as much as possible. It sounded, oh, from what we were hearing, Joao was up for it. So, the group of the favourites caught us. Yeah, 4 or 5K from the final climb, and Seri stayed on the front, I stayed with Joao and moved him up. And yeah, I guess pretty close to the win. Well, it was a pretty exceptional ride. I mean, I have to say, as much as I'd want Joao to win, Dan Martin, wow, yeah. Can't help but think he sort of deserved that one, the way he rode today. Holding everyone off, I don't think he had much more than a minute 30 or so at the bottom of the climb, and it was a hard climb. Really steep. It was maybe harder than the Zonkland, to be honest. It was just like a steady 8, 10, 12% the whole way up. There was a couple of little plateaus. They were nice. Lots of crowds. Got pushed quite a bit. That was nice. Needed that. And yeah, just sort of groveled up. Tried to spin out the day's break. But yeah, I was pretty cooked by this point. Back was pretty tight, pretty sore lower back. I'm not sure if that was just from pushing into that headwind or for a little bit of a... I did bash my back a little bit on that crash a couple of days ago, 3 days ago. But yeah, I was suffering up the last climb. So even if I'd survived, I don't think I would have been going anywhere. So can't really complain, but just happy to be up the road, happy to be in the mix. And yeah, other than that, obviously Remco crashed. Haven't actually really seen him. I got back to the bush, shower changed, took my food, jumped in the car. But I did see him. I did have to stop by the road, get out of the way for the gruppetto to pass. And he didn't look good. And then heard from Mikkel, and you know, he was struggling. I think there's a mobile x-ray unit that goes to the race. I think he's going straight there to be checked. Of which news I have no idea. But yeah, from my perspective, a crash on stage 17 in your first Grand Tour when you're already pretty depleted, already hurting, already psychologically a bit broken, really gonna probably finish him off, if I'm being honest. I mean, we'll see, obviously. I'm not gonna count him out, but yeah, it's going to be hard just to get to Milan even now. But obviously, João, big time on the up. One of those things, and there's been a lot of talk. A lot of talk about what we should have done, this and that. But, yeah, I think even João would say it was a bit of a howler now, losing time, or that much time, like he did on Cecil. I'm not exactly sure what went so wrong. And yeah, then with Remco second in GC for so long, it was sort of semi-obliged. Yeah, I mean, we would have looked like fools if you hadn't have waited on the first on the Strada Bianca stage when he was second in GC, and then, yeah, it's all gone. Yeah, one's going one way, one's going the other, but as is life, so is life. Not much we can do about that now. Would be great to see João get a win. I think he's the man to do it in the team at the minute. Unless Remy can pull something spectacular out of the bag tomorrow or in the TT. Long day tomorrow, 230k. Some bumps at the end. Don't know if anyone will be up for controlling that one either, so it could be another day to try and get in the break. We'll have to try and be still active, try and get guys up the road. Yeah, but other than that, a good day out. We went from one extreme, being too cold and crying about it for the last 16 stages, to too hot and sweating and wishing it was cooler. So yeah, I mean, I just can't win, can I? I'm just gonna, all I can do is complain, which people seem to be taking note of. Sorry about that.
And can we have 30 seconds of indulging 30 Brian seconds. And maybe also myself on what we might drink tonight? We mentioned that today could have been the wine stage. Brian, last couple of days, Rich and I, so we're in Trentino Alto Adige already, and, well, we've had a couple of nice bottles of Lagrime, which I was quite taken by. My kind of wine, it's dark, it's intense, real sort of dark chocolate flavours. I enjoyed it.
I'm going to try and find something from the other end of the spectrum, some lighter, energetic.
Something light and tippy-tappy.
No, not tippy-tappy.
Beaujolais style.
Beaujolais is changing majorly these years. I'll tell you about that another time. No, I want to see some freshness in the wines here in the same way that the Giro has now come back to life.
What will you do if you don't see any freshness? That sounds like a threat. You're going to start exacting, meeting out punishment if you don't see freshness in the wine.
Well, you might
want to be going around the cantinas tomorrow.
No, I know how to find. I'm known to find good wines on any wine list. I'm sure we can pick up something nice. I really rate this area in general. I think the lighter style wines with good acidity. I'm not into the dark stuff as much as you are, Daniel. So we'll just have to meet halfway.
Oh, it could be corkscrews at 10 paces tonight.
I just like nice wine. I'll take your lead. I'll take your direction, chaps. I trust your judgment.
What are we going to eat? Are we? I've sort of lost my bearings. Are we still going to be in this sort of Spätzle, Canada?
I hope not. I hope
neck
not.
Of the woods tonight.
You're more of a mountain person than me.
Yes.
Man of the mountains. Well, listen, well, there's lots more ground to cover over the next few days with Brian.
Including tomorrow morning, a bit of a challenge.
Oh, yeah, a bit of a challenge,
which Brian doesn't know about, but Brian doesn't have to be involved. But the listeners will hear about it in the episode tomorrow.
They will. In the meantime, thank you very much, Daniel.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, and welcome back, Brian.
Cheers, Richard. Thanks, Daniel.